At a ceremony in Little Rock, both men were given an Airman's Medal for Heroism, the highest peacetime honor that the Air Force can bestow. Kennedy didn't want to accept it, but his local congressman in Maine, David Emery, said that if he took the medal, the Air Force would allow him to leave. Kennedy was given the medal by Vern Orr, the Secretary of the Air Force, in a room full of reporters. Airmen's medals were also given to Rex Huckle, Don Green, Jimmy Roberts, and David Livingston's father. Intended to boost morale, the awards ceremony was dismissed by the PTS crews. They thought it was a public relations stunt, and couldn't understand why Jim Sandacre, who'd returned to the launch complex twice after the accident, didn't get the highest honor, too. Jeff Kennedy was granted a temporary medical leave by reason of disability 3 days after receiving his medal. Although the Air Force could recall him to duty in the future, Kennedy's military career was essentially over. He moved back to Maine, sued Martin Marietta for $7.5 million, and settled out of court for a much smaller sum. Greg Devlin also left the Air Force within days of receiving the Airman's Medal. His term of enlistment was over, and his lawsuit was settled out of court as well. After attorney fees, court costs, and other charges were deducted, Devlin got a check for $6,400. The accidents at Grand Forks and Damascus had occurred during the same week, and Bob Purifoy hoped that they would prompt a serious interest in weapon safety at the Pentagon. He traveled to Washington, D.C., and briefed a group of Air Force officials on the design flaws that could detonate a Mark 28 hydrogen bomb during a fire, and the need to retrofit the bombs with new safety mechanisms. The Air Force Inspector General and the head of the Air Force Directorate of Nuclear Safety attended the meeting, but it had little effect. A study commissioned by the Air Force later questioned the possibility of an accidental detonation and argued that the Mark 28 didn't need to be removed from bombers on alert. The study did, however, urge the Air Force to expedite the proposed retrofit of the 28, and in the meantime, take extraordinary steps to prevent and ameliorate fires that might involve the unmodified 28s. Neither of those recommendations was followed. The Department of Defense had made its spending priorities clear. Safety modifications on older weapons like the Mark 28, while desirable, could wait. But Purifoy was determined to keep fighting the nuclear bureaucracy, and he was willing to engage in a bit of devious behavior on behalf of weapon safety. After almost 20 years of fierce resistance, the Strategic Air Command had finally agreed to put locks in its bombs. The installation of permissive action links would require new control boxes in the cockpits of SAC's bombers. Under a contract with the Department of Energy, those new control boxes would be produced by Sandia. Purifoy quietly arranged for a unique signal generator to be installed in the boxes, along with the coded switch necessary to unlock the PALs. The officials at the Air Force Logistics Command who handled the contract may or may not have understood the purpose of this special added feature. It allowed all of SAC's bombers to carry nuclear weapons employing the latest safety devices. The planes would soon be ready, and now Purifoy had to find a way to get those devices into the weapons. The Reagan administration's military buildup was expected to cost approximately $1.5 trillion during its first 5 years. About $250 billion would be spent on nuclear weapons systems. By the end of the 1980s, the United States would have about 14,000 strategic warheads and bombs, an increase of about 60%. The Navy would get new cruise missiles and Trident submarines. The Air Force would get new cruise missiles, 2 new strategic bombers, and 100 long-range MX missiles, now renamed the Peacemaker. The Carter administration's plan to hide MX missiles amid thousands of square miles in the American Southwest was soon abandoned. Instead, the missiles would be deployed in existing silos, defeating their original purpose and leaving them vulnerable to attack. The only military use of the peacemaker would be a first strike on the Soviet Union. The Army's Pershing II missiles and land-based cruise missiles were among the most controversial weapons proposed by the Reagan administration. They were to be placed in Western Europe as a counterbalance to the SS-20 missiles recently deployed by the Soviet Union. The SS-20 was not considered a strategic weapon, and therefore not covered by existing arms control agreements, because its range was only 3,000 miles. An SS-20 missile couldn't reach targets in the United States, but its three warheads could destroy NATO bases and European cities. The Army's Cruise and Pershing II missiles were intended as a nuclear tit-for-tat, and yet the Soviet Union considered their deployment extremely provocative. The Pershing II had a range of about 1,000 miles and an accuracy of about 200 feet. From bases in West Germany, the Pershing II could destroy command centers in Moscow within 5 or 6 minutes. It would give the United States the capability to launch a super-sudden first strike. The new missiles, bombers, and subs gained the most attention in the press. But the highest priority element of Reagan's strategic modernization program was the need to improve the command and control system. "This system must be foolproof in case of any foreign attack," Reagan said. A handful of limited war options would finally be included in the PSYOP, and the ability to fight a protracted nuclear war depended on the survival of command and control facilities for days, weeks, or even months. The Pentagon also sought greater interoperability, a system that could quickly transmit messages between civilian and military leaders, between the United States and NATO, even between different branches of the American Armed Services. General Richard Ellis, the head of SAC, told Congress that at a bare minimum, the command and control system had to recognize that we are under attack, to characterize that attack, get a decision from the president, and disseminate that decision to the forces prior to the first weapon impacting upon the United States. The Reagan administration planned to make an unprecedented investment in command and control, spending about $18 billion on new early warning radars and communications satellites, better protection against nuclear weapon effects and electromagnetic pulse, the creation of a global positioning system, GPS,